Jerry told me when I got out here tonight that I was going to speak about what individuals can do, what people can do to meet the many crises that so obviously and painfully face our nation at this time. It's one of the hardest questions. I got a great lesson in it back in 1961 when I watched President Kennedy make his inaugural address, in which probably the most famous line was in his, I can only say, beautiful voice and style, was, "Ask not what your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country." About a week later, I was sitting in my office over at the Department of Justice, and they started bringing in big sacks of mail, literally, big bags of mail. And with them came a note from Robert Kennedy, Bob, the Attorney General, saying the President asked him to answer these letters. He needed a little help. And he said, "You got a lot of people down there. Would you mind answering them?" Well, we looked through them to design some. I mean, you couldn't answer each one individually. There were thousands of them. And I didn't get them all. There were other people in the department. Apparently, they got some, too. But if not a majority, a great number asked, "What can I do for my country?" It's pretty hard to ponder and decide, how do you answer something like that? Because finally, the individual has to know herself, know her commitment, know what she believes in, know what her energies are and what her talents are, and do it. But you can't just say, "Hey, wake up, look around and find your way." But it is one of the more difficult things for people to decide. The first step, though, is clearly what are the most important personal responsibilities of the individual to address the plight of the country and the plight of the world. It'd be hard to find anything more urgent than peace, or anything more awful. And still, to me, after all these years, unbelievable than war. And examining the total scene, it's become pretty clear to me at this time that the greatest and continuing threat to peace in the world is U.S. military expenditure. We've had a generation of militarism. I should know, I started out, I was 13 on the 7th of December, and on the 8th I was downtown Los Angeles, where we were even living, trying to enlist, literally. And the bug didn't leave me. And when I became 17, I joined the Marines. The war was over, you can tell if you count, because, I mean, the war was still going on, but I was 17, and I was still 17 when the war was over, even though I was in the Marines. But then I looked back at the enormous dominant role, not always sensed by everybody, that militarism has played in our lives. And it's gotten worse. I can't tell you that the political parties have been terribly different on the issue. I can tell you that I've seen the best, in my opinion, among the Congress people almost cry. I saw one great representative from Denver cry because what could she do? She'd vote against the budget on other projects, but in her district, the major employer was a single contractor, military contractor, and there was a huge military base. It's hard to find a congressional district where the military doesn't have a major, major presence. We're spending more on the military of our country alone than all the rest of the countries in the world are spending, as you know. And what a stunning fact. What's the matter with us? That we're caught in this vice. I don't mean the mechanical instrument, but the immoral purpose of spending billions and billions and trillions on militarism. We sell more arms to others to kill each other as well. Not quite than the rest of the world combined, because commercialism features more significantly there, but we spend far more than, we sell more arms, far more arms and ammunition to others than any other country, and give it away so they can go out and kill people. And we absolutely have to come to grips with it. And what does the individual do? I've seen 4 instances of heroic struggle against powerful governments and brutal governments. Prevail. I spent some months altogether in 1975, 76, 77. I was still in Iran in 78, the day the Shah left. He had a huge army. He had more tanks than the British Army. He bought $26 billion in arms from the United States between 1972 and 1976. He had Sidewinder missiles for his aircraft, which no other country except the United States had, not the UK or anybody, because he was number one for us. There were 3 weapon systems that Congress authorized on the basis of the commitment that he had made to make purchases from the weapons when they were produced. And the people took to the streets. It's the last resort of the people, nonviolently. And they took to the streets by the thousands and by the tens of thousands and by the hundreds of thousands. And finally, by 77, every weekend there were millions on the streets of the country. There would be 1 million to 2 million every weekend in Tehran. And finally, they closed down everything. I mean, they closed down the factories, they closed down the government. I mean, we were speaking to the Shah's Atomic Energy Commission, where he had 600 very angry scientists who had studied in Caltech and Vienna and all over the world how to make nuclear energy. And they were outraged at what the government was doing to the people. Young women would walk up to soldiers with a long rose stem. The Iranians love roses, as did their great poet Hafez, and try to stick the stem down the barrel and say, "Why do you kill us? We're your sisters." In that last year in Jolly Square in August, on Black Friday, Huey helicopters fabricated, that is, put together in Esfahan, a city of perfect beauty that had 500,000 people in 1500 and 500,000 people in 1960, but now had 1.5 million, including refugees, including farmers, and the agricultural business had been destroyed, and the agriculture irrigation system destroyed that had fed the people for many, many generations. With 50 caliber machine guns in the bay, were over Jolly Square and fired on people that were in the main wearing burial shrouds. Not because they really thought they'd be killed necessarily, but because they realized that many had been killed and that they might be, and about 150 were mowed down. The Shah killed as many as he dared that last year, at least 45,000. And then he saw you can't kill all the people. And he fled. William Colby, who was director of the CIA, said the proudest achievement of the CIA was restoring the Shah to the throne in 1953. In 1978, he leaves. The proudest achievement of the CIA. But the people, together, had taken to the streets and closed down everything. The air over Tehran, which is always polluted, was so clear you could see Mount Dimavan in the distance from which you can see, as the U.S. used for an observation plan, the testing range for Soviet missiles at that time. In the Philippines, I sat in the cabinet row in the Congress when Marcos came to speak to the Congress, and he gave a better 4th of July speech than I'd ever heard any member of the Congress make, a stem winder. But he treated the people brutally with military force. I'd known Benigno Aquino well and helped get him over here to Houston, where he needed literally heart surgery, and finally to Harvard, where he got a job. And he insisted on going back. And Marcos had him held on the plane and taken down a ladder on the back of the plane when the rest of the passengers had been taken out, and shot in the back of the head before he, Marcos had said, your feet will never touch Philippine soil while you're alive. And today in Makati, there's a powerful statue of a ladder just going up into the air like that, with the human figure lurching forward, a symbol of the brutality of the Marcos government. And the people took to the streets. I went with crowds that would clearly be 500,000 people standing out in the broiling sun for hours and hours, chanting, Corey, 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 waiting for Corks on the Kino to come. And they drove Marcos from the country. He too killed as many as he dared. Just this week, we had a dinner for a man named Marchando. He's, since August the 18th, the Prime Minister of Nepal. He studied agriculture. He was born in absolute poverty. Nepal is one of the poorest countries in the world. Per capita income, even today, is under $800. Infant mortality is about 80 to 90 deaths per 1,000 live births. There's no figure in human statistics that means more to me than, or tells me more about a people than infant mortality. And we have to remember, as you know better than I, it's not just the infants that die. It's all the others that didn't fully develop. It's all the others that suffered from the same thing that caused the infants to die that did. The conditions of the people there, illiteracy is 37%, something like that. It had been a feudal kingdom. I mean, a feudal kingdom with serfs from 1768 until 2006. For Sean to explain in ways that I haven't heard, that's a nom de guerre, as they say. Oh, he's a nonviolent person in purpose. It's said to mean fierce. And he's fierce in his commitment to the human condition and to all humanity and to end war. But by 1980, he had decided that working in agriculture, he'd gotten an agricultural degree. People live on their own subsistence agriculture and what they can produce for landlords as serfs. He decided he'd have to go political and go underground and remain basically underground for 25 years. In 1996, he dared to come out and plead with the kingdom and the king. The king had an army of about 45,000 in a country that is today about 25 million, and plead with him to open the country up. At that time, he wanted a constituent assembly to create a constitution that would provide rights for the people and democratic processes. And he got brushed aside rather roughly. They tried to demonstrate, 25, 30 people out there, they got beat up and arrested. So they began to wage a war, a guerrilla warfare initially. And by 7 years, they had taken over with about 5,000 fighters. They'd taken over about 80% of the country. And then he did a most remarkable thing. And he did it before Cincinnati, when the war was over. He said he was going to join a new parliamentary force of 7 parties in seeking a parliament and reform and an end to the kingdom. Only he was seeking the end of the kingdom, not the other 7 parties. And his men laid down their arms. And the only way he could go forward was to urge the people of the country to take to the streets. In Kathmandu, which is today about 500,000, they put out 350,000 people on the streets. And the king, fortunately, was wise enough to see that you can't kill the people, and didn't try. By 2006, they had an agreement on going forward. In April of this year, they voted on a constituent assembly. They drafted a constitution. As I said earlier, he was elected prime minister. And he has great hopes and great dreams for his people, for their development, and for people everywhere. It was essentially a nonviolent revolution. And to the extent that it was violent, it broke off midterm, something that we haven't seen here. Sandinistas and others that I've supported for years, although I oppose all violence and I'm a pacifist, fought all the way, but it enabled him to have reconciliation among all the people. It enabled him, when they had the constituent assembly election, to get far more votes than anybody else. His party got twice as many votes as the second largest party, even though they couldn't even have poll watchers close by. They could stand at a distance and they could count their own people who voted. And they won the election, and now they're on their way, we hope. Our own civil rights movement, we shouldn't forget. The March on Washington, 500,000 people. The movement couldn't have started without that sort of mass commitment. It continued. We ought to remember from the speech already quoted from Dr. King in April of 1967, when he spoke at the Riverside Church, his most famous line, the line that almost broke up the civil rights movement, because black folks said it's hard enough in this country to be black and we're working for our own rights without being un-American and against our war in Vietnam. He said, "The greatest purveyor of violence on earth is my own country." And he was absolutely right. Violence toward others and violence within ourselves. We permitted an entertainment industry to glorify violence constantly. Mind-boggling, the amount of violence in TV and movies. Mindless, crazy violence, cruel violence, seen all the time by our children and grandchildren. If we're going to do anything about the military budget, you're not going to be able to do it with individual members of the Congress. You can start with them. You have to keep maximum pressure on them. You have to know them. You have to plead with them. But to break it open, we're going to have to have a mass movement. And this may be the most opportune time we could hope for, with our economy perhaps justly breaking open. What a cruel and stupid thing to sell somebody a home with a bigger mortgage than you know they can pay. God help us, you know. Don't you know that's a family and a future? And you just want the money. And how many? How many times? the greatest threat in war that we have, and it's much greater than we like to realize, and it's growing, in my opinion, is nuclear war. And we have to include within the reduction of the military budget the demand that the United States comply with its solemn obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaties that it signed in 1968 and envision the end of nuclear weapons on the planet. The then six known nuclear powers agreed in return for the more than 140 at the time, powers that the governments did not have the nuclear weapons, in return for their agreement not to seek nuclear weapons in any way, that they would systematically eliminate all nuclear weapons and the technology would be destroyed by which they were made. And today, while we threaten Iran, it's as great a threat to ourselves as it is to Iran if we're wise enough to see it. And while we threaten North Korea, we're spending more money on nuclear weapons than the rest of the world combined, as far as we know. We're not only replacing the nuclear weapons we have, we only still have 10 or 12 Trident nuclear submarines in service on the seas, capable of striking any place within hours on the planet. But we're developing new generations and spending billions on it of nuclear weapons. And how do we think the countries we threaten can hope to abandon the quest for a bomb or two? Because they know if they can get one, it's going to be dangerous to attack them if they're near anything that we care about. North Korea is too close to Seoul and too close to even Japan. We wouldn't care about China, perhaps, but we just don't want them to hit something that's that close to us, particularly we've got division-strength troops in both countries, lo, these many decades after World War II. Those are what we can hope to do. They're a priority of enormous urgency. And no progress can be made, in my opinion. I remember Madeleine Albright, who, you recall, she was on the CBS Sunday morning show. She was asked, based on the food and agriculture, UN Food and Agriculture report that said 585,000 children under the age of five had died as a direct result of U.S. sanctions. That's genocide. And she was asked what was her response to that, and her answer was, well, frankly, that's not a matter that concerns me very much. She tried to apologize for it in her autobiography, but how can you apologize for that? And what's an apology worth when you did it, you know? And the rest of the 1.5 million that died were elderly and chronically ill. If you had something that required constant medication or treatment, dialysis or anything, you were dead within a year after the sanctions went on. We did it. And it wasn't George Bush. He's clearly the most violent. He enjoys it the most. He executed 152 people as governor. Didn't sign a single commutation. He claims to have signed one, but he didn't. The parole board had already agreed that and they included women. They included minors, that is, people under the age of 17 in violation of international law at the time the crime was committed. They included retarded people, something I can hardly stand. We have a terribly handicapped daughter now. She's the joy and love of our life. How can you kill a retarded person? Never batted an eye. And we reelected him. We failed to impeach him. Lawyers have special obligations. and our bar has failed tragically. The United States is basically ridiculed all the laws that all the cultures of all the peoples have developed through all the years, seeking to create a condition in which the equal dignity of every man, woman, and child on earth is respected. And we torture and glorify it. We condemn Cuba for violating human rights, and there's twice as many prisoners in Guantanamo, which we've held criminally and illegally since 1905, really a little longer, but since the Platt Amendment gave us the right to use it for refueling station. We ignored the thousands of Haitians that perished at Guantanamo. Haitians never count. Haitians probably suffer more than any other national group on earth, even more than Iraq. But Iraq was inflicted by us. And to a very considerable degree, what's happened to Haiti is inflicted by us. We had Marines in there for 15 years and developed conditions for Papa Doc. We drove Aristide out twice. The first time we thought he'd be killed, he was saved by the French. Mitterrand had trained some Haitians to protect him, and they got him in the back of the car of the French ambassador, who drove him to the airport in a Venezuelan aircraft, took him out. The second time we took him out ourselves and didn't know where to take him, finally took him to Central African Republic. And the people to this day chant in the streets and get beaten for it or shot for it. Aristide, Aristide, Aristide. The lawyers have failed to act on impeachment of crime after crime, shredding the Bill of Rights, shredding the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and which is only a declaration, and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Every last right there. Big men pay no attention to those impediments to our will. A little item in the New York Times today about a 600-man firm, in the, or 600-person lawyer firm, and I think it said San Francisco, this meeting today about breaking up because they, one of their big clients was, was WAMU, and the firm's going to have to break up because our orientation is commercial fees, fat fees, go where the money is. And we've got a prison population that is absolutely staggering. More than 2 million people in felony conviction custody at this moment. Their lives broken up, their chances, their families' chances destroyed. We spent more on prisons in the last 40 years every year than we have on public housing. And there are lots of folks living in pretty poor housing. And the lawyers aren't doing their part. Each of us has to ask herself, what can I do? The doctors have perhaps the most important human obligation of all, not just to heal the sick, but to bring health care to the whole society. I'd urge you to read a book that I've just gone over. I'm going from preaching to meddling now, as you can tell. I always do. What's the point of... Arnold Relway was a private practitioner for a good many years, and then he taught at Harvard Medical School for, I think, about 17 years, and then he became editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, which has always seemed to me a very sensitive publication on problems of health care. And he's written a book called A Second Opinion, to come out this year. I just read about it in the bulletin for the American Association for Arts and Sciences. But what I read about it, he wrote a long article, about a six-page article in there. A Second Opinion, Rescuing America's Health Care. He points out that in 1966, which was the year of the largest increase in federal expenditures under the poverty program, which had more than tripled federal expenditures for health care, that 6% of the total economy of the United States was devoted to health care. And 20 years later, I shouldn't say 20 years later, 40 years later, it's now 16%. And at the time that he wrote, probably not now, the proportion of the economic output of the country that was going to health care was growing at twice the rate of the overall economy. And he predicted that in 5 to 10 years, the cost will be so great that our medical care system will have to be radically addressed. I would urge all the doctors here to read that book. He's a man of goodwill, and he sees a disaster in the field that he has devoted his entire life to. And he sees the problem is not insurance, finally. The problem is cost. And he itemizes ways that you could reduce cost under the present system that drain off so much of the money that is spent and provide the same level of health care for the same population at 35 to 40% less than what's now being spent. But if we're going to end our military expenditures and our development of new weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear weapons, we're going to have to be strong enough and healthy enough to stand up and march and sing and believe that we shall overcome. The answer to the question that came in the letters to the president is that, as I said earlier, each of us has to examine who we are and what we know and what we do and how we can help from that perspective make this a better country and a better world, and do it as our first priority with our might. And we're way behind. What's happening to major parts of the country's structure, the financial parts and all, are only symptomatic of conditions in most of the other parts. Because we permitted a materialistic culture to dominate our values and take us down the wrong road. It's time for change, as we've heard somebody else say lately. And your organization has always played a major role in this field, and that's why I would violate the Constitution of the United States by placing you twice in jeopardy tonight. It's good to be with you, and thanks for all you do, and I want to do more.